Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, hello. Happy John is our new Fearless Leader week, I guess.
Yeah, let's go with that. I wouldn't consider myself an overlord, necessarily. I would, just as I said in numerous posts, nothing really changes on the face of anything, because I've been running things kind of behind the scenes for a while. But as people saw today, and for those listening yesterday, Kanye West will now be a larger part of our site, which is, to me, fun. Kind of changes, doesn't super change the tone, but it changes the tone enough that we're hip to what the kids are listening to.
I mean, if any artist in this generation screams central to New York to me, it's Kanye. So, I appreciate it. I think we are both probably among the higher, the upper echelon of Kanye fans / Syracuse sports fans.
That Venn diagram is not large.
Despite the fact that he somehow failed to perform in New York City, despite being scheduled to do so like five different times over in the second half of 2016, but it's fine. Including once I was supposed to go to. Yeah. I appreciated your post today, as I thought I made clear with my response pun.
There were so many puns between you and Kevin. I feel like we're going to be rolling in puns now for Kanye West related content.
I thought that was an appropriate way to ring in the new era of Troy Nunes as an absolute magician.
Very, very much so.
Just a completely unprompted reimagining of I Love Kanye.
There it is. No, and that was a much more enjoyable ringing in than the actual Syracuse basketball team gave me, which was a resounding loss to Virginia Tech on my birthday, ruining everything between them and Clemson. I'm distraught this week, Dan.
Yeah, this is basically the facts of Syracuse basketball seasons. Like, it stuck towards the end of like a lot of really good stuff, and then it's like track number 17 of 18 or whatever, and it's like, what is this? Why is this here?
Yeah. I thought we were done with the skits.
In the life, it's not even a skit, it's a bad song. I'd rather have the skits, even though the skits were pretty brutal too. In the life of Pop, the life of Boeheim, it's like right at the end, and you're like, I wish they could have just left this one off. Like, we were okay without this one. Just get to Fade. Fade's great, and hopefully Boeheim has his own Fade.
Yeah, hit skip, and then move on to another win, hopefully, because we were doing really well. I know last week we called in right after the Miami win. That was nice, and then we beat Pitt, which was surprising, and then we did this, which wasn't really surprising. And I tweeted from the Nunes account yesterday. There was a lot of people like very surprised by that outcome. You can be as optimistic as you want, and I think you should have been optimistic based on the two games previous, but if you told yourself that couldn't happen, then you haven't been paying attention to what this season has yielded so far.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, what is this, like, this might be the, like, most forgivable Syracuse loss, so I A, it wasn't surprising.
Loss. Way to go, SU.
Yeah, I mean,
they finally picked up one of those.
Yeah, that's what was missing on Syracuse's resume, was a good quality loss probable tournament team ish. Virginia Tech
got
was
the resume.
They right now they're obviously they would be in the tournament today. They had some iffy losses before this, but the ACC, like, people are going to get those. The problem is most teams did their work non-conference and Syracuse didn't. So things would look a lot different if Syracuse had its normal non-conference of like one or two maybe losses. The five just it doesn't make things all that tenable. But if we're taking this like on a completely like just on its own merits, like it's. You can't really get too worked up about a loss at Virginia Tech, where they haven't lost in a long time. A pretty good basketball team, a good coach, a coach who has proven that he knows how to play against the zone, which is not everyone's strong suit, cough, Tom Crean, cough. In and of itself, it's not the like end of the world. The problem is like the world might have already ended, and we just like are looking for something to tell us that it hasn't, and this definitely didn't do that.
Like I said before the game, I mean, Buzz knows how to coach against Syracuse. the fact that less talented Virginia Tech teams are able to test us before and test better Syracuse teams should have been at least some sort of a dead giveaway. I mean, the last few games have come down to either overtime or 2 points. I think that was the last three contests, actually. So, I mean, again, Buzz knows how to beat us. This is the first time Virginia Tech's beaten us in 1977, which, yeah, we strung together 8 straight wins. I know I said in the kind of, you know, basic info article I wrote a couple days ago, despite the fact that we were in the Big East for so long together, Virginia Tech basketball didn't join the Big East until, like, 2000.
Yeah, then they were out, like, three or four years later, so.
It's, like, completely, like, blocked that out for some reason.
Yeah, Big East, like, for those who don't remember, was weird and not well run.
We were in the Big East West for, like, 2 years.
Which almost kind of makes sense if you look at... I barely remember that there was a Big East West, which is lovely. It's a whole thing. The Big East, the way the Big East like formed and switched and had divisions for a hot minute and everything else, just weird. I guess if there was a Big East West, Syracuse like would have to be in there because like a lot of them are very Eastern seaboard-ish, and Syracuse is not.
Well, looking at like, I mean, this is probably going to create a tangent. But, like, there was, like, a 3 or 4 year stretch where, like, a bunch of conferences had divisions in college basketball. And, like, most of them were mimicking, like, back when, like, it was, like, right around the late 90s when a bunch of football conferences went to divisions. So, like, the SEC, Conference USA, the MAC, I think a few others. And they kind of decided to, you know, reconfigure basketball for scheduling purposes to reflect that and figured they'd, like, create some sort of, you know, brand equity in the divisions. It just, it never worked out. It never really made any sense. Because you could easily just create a scheduling matrix that mimics exactly what you did.
Yeah, I get the idea of trying to, like, add some equity to rivalries. It just doesn't, it's not that necessary because, like, Syracuse is probably on the upper echelon of, like, schools that have a lot of rivals, like, in basketball, which is, you know, we always make the joke about how we have, like, probably too many rivals in basketball and none in football. But, like, back in the Big East, like, we had UConn, Georgetown. This is in no particular order because it should be Georgetown, UConn. Nova, St. John's, and probably more schools that would consider us a rival that we really didn't care about. BC, obviously, back in the day. Still don't really care. Pitt, like, all these schools that there are some kind of modicum of rivalry, where most only have, like, one or two. And there it's like, well, do we really need to do a whole division to, like, make this more of a thing when we can just schedule them twice?
Right.
And then you have, like, the fact that basketball schedules are just really long. I guess it would make almost more sense now with the 16-team or the 18-team league. Or, it's not 18. 15 or 16-team leagues, but still not all that necessary if you just protect rivalry games in the scheduling. People also forget that, like, the Big East tried sits fouls for a while, and I always see that come back up as like, oh, why doesn't college go to sits fouls? And it's like, A, I don't think people remember or realize that college games are like 8 minutes shorter than the NBA and the fouls correlate. Mm-hmm. And B, like, the Big East did it and got rid of it, what, after two seasons for a reason. Like, it did not go well.
The one thing I will say, and I know others have supported this too, I do believe that you should be given an additional foul per overtime.
I can buy that. I think that's fine.
I don't think you should be checked back in, though. Like, I think if you commit 5 in regulation, you're out. But if you have 4 and then you hit 5 in overtime, I think you get another one.
Yeah, I'd be fine with that. Like, because that scales up. That makes sense. Because, I'd be fine with that now. I would not be fine with that if we wanted to retroactively change the 2009 season. Because I think the 5-foul rule benefited Syracuse in a lot of ways that year.
Very much so.
Even though Hasheem Thabeet, I would argue, committed 13 fouls before he fouled out.
Minimum.
I think we counted a couple. Like, I think we were on a bus ride to a football game in its pit, and we actually decided to put in the sits overtime game because that ride's infinitely long, and count how many fouls Hasheem Thabeet committed, and I think it was like 12 or 13, and he fouled out in the fourth overtime. So that was fun.
Sounds like an article.
Still won. That's some straight, like, off-season content.
Yeah,
let's don't count how many fouls this player, who is now, like, is even in the NBA still, I don't think so, committed during the sixth overtime game 7 years ago, or, like, 8 years ago.
I mean, I'm definitely interested in stuff like that, because you know what, like, the site is I feel like expertly tailored and always has been to off-season content.
And just like minutiae, like that's straight minutiae. I do think people would read that because like just taking a random like mid-June shot at I guess we have lacrosse, so like a like mid-July shot at UConn's never a bad thing.
Just call it an oral history.
Yeah, I mean, someone has done. There's been an oral history on Since Overtime Noom. I remember it was pretty good.
No, I know that. I'm saying
just the DO did it.
Maybe? The DO did it. Just like have an oral history of the time who she seems to be at 13,000. Just talk about that.
And then, oh, that'd be so good.
Make it not even an oral history. Just like just add some nice graphics, like his interstitials. I mean, that sounds like a troll nonsense post we'd do. Dan, speaking about the actual game against Virginia Tech, I think we'll probably talk about that for a little bit in the first half of the podcast here. How much of an effect do you think Tyler Lydon's apparent injury had on the loss? Do you feel like it was the reason? It seemed like a lot of people were sold on that on Twitter. I wasn't sold on that fact. It just seemed like he was obviously an issue, you know, at center. He just wasn't as spry as he normally would be, but between point guard play, the fact that we weren't able to defend the interior part of the zone or the exterior, and when that happens, everything just kind of implodes. I think Lydon was a reason. I don't think he was the reason. I'm curious if you agree.
Do you repeat that? I dropped my internet drop for a second, so I was like out for a minute there.
All good. No,
I can't believe I actually came back without you having stopped.
That's actually shocking. So what I was saying was I was very, very curious about if you felt that Lydon was the reason that Syracuse lost and really struggled on the defensive end, or if you felt like he was just a reason, because it seemed like on Twitter a lot of people were saying it was the reason.
I don't think it's unfair to say it was a major one. It's tough because, like, clearly the team, I think we've proven so far this year, the team performs best when he is the best player on the floor. And he has the ability to be. I don't think he's like, he's almost like not ready for prime time. Obviously, he had like no showed last night. He had 7 rebounds, which is nice, and that was it. He had 1 for 5 from the field, and so like, Tyler Lydon needs to take more shots than 5, even if he's not hitting. Like, Lydon should have been 1 for 12 last night, not 1 for 5. He needs to keep on shooting. But I think he is struggling to find his role within the offense, and it's tough in college basketball for a forward to be, and a non-ball handler to be, like, the go-to guy. Like, we've seen that even years where we've had really good ones. Like, Wes Johnson, like, was our best player. I don't know that I would say he was our go-to guy. Like, he hit open shots, he was really efficient, but he wasn't, like, a ball-dominant player.
Which is why he never should have been drafted where he was.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Andy Routens was, like, more of the go-to guy. Plus, Scoop was great. Plus, Trish was very good. Plus, everyone else was, like, oh, even more, even like Chris Joseph was more of a ball dominant player than him. So you have this, like, it's very rarely, I mean, it's very hard. Like, I'd say the 2 times we've had recently where our clear focal point of the offense has been a front court player, and Lydon's more diverse than either of these guys offensively, but we're like Rick Jackson, and he had a lot more help, and Rack a couple years ago, who didn't have more help, but was just so good that it didn't matter. So I think this is like, I just don't think he's quite there. Like, he has the skills, he has games where he goes nuts, he's super efficient, like, when he has those games. I think he can almost stand to be a little more selfish, I think, and I just don't think our backcourt play is good enough to like, have him doped for 2 points. So I don't know that I would really put all the blame on him, but, like, clearly if you get a 14-point game from Lydon, it's a different ballgame than what it you know, ended up being, which was a 10-point Virginia Tech win. So, yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of players could have played better last night. Torian was great, obviously, but he's still kind of lost on defense, which is to be expected. How often do people who are thrown into playing, like, power forward in some center adjust to the defense in the first year? I don't remember the last person to, like, play really effective interior defense in the zone in year one. Battle was, like, okay. White was okay, but, like, neither of those guys were super efficient. Roberson
was
alive, 14 and 10, like 7 for 8 from the field. He had some nice putbacks.
And
he's clearly like,
off on him.
Well, that's just going to happen. Paul Harris played like 36 minutes a game and Boeheim found times to tee off on him. in 09. But yeah, I think Leiden was definitely a major factor. If he plays better, Syracuse, you know, if they don't win that game, they put forth a better showing. That only counts for so much in the position Syracuse is in, unfortunately. But that, I mean, that's been an issue in a lot of Syracuse's losses, is Leiden struggles to get himself going. Our guards haven't found, you know, there just isn't that chemistry where the guards know exactly when to find Leiden, when to, how to set him up for plays. So I think that's like one of the things this team really needs to solve if it's going to hit its ceiling going forward. On the bright side, it might mean Tyler Leiden's here next year. So, I don't know that, you know, that's going to just calm too many people down, but that is reality. I don't know that you can count on Leiden being two and done after like what he's looked like this year, because he, you know, there are front door players that he drafted in the NBA, and yeah, a lot of it's based on potential, which he has, but he's also now exposed himself as more of a liability in terms of not being able to hit his own shot and not being able to be a focal point.
Right. And I think those are great points. You know, last year as a sixth man, he was able to carve out a niche for himself. I think this year, you're right, like, as a focal point, he can't create his own shot, but he's also dealing with a situation where, you know, he's got unfamiliar guard play, nobody's really set up to feed him the ball, so, I mean, we live in a world where Chris McCullough was drafted in the first round, so I don't necessarily think it's out of the question that Leiden leaves.
No, definitely not. It's never out of the question in college basketball. Like, you can never say this person is absolutely not leaving until the date passes.
Right. I think, to be honest, I think he's somebody who's a prime example who would take advantage. I mean, Torian might too, to be honest. Guys who are going to take advantage of the new rules that allow them to really get some good opinions about their draft status and stock and then depart. I think this is a whole nother conversation about recruiting for later. That, you know, if Leiden stays, we're obviously in a much better position than if he goes. But yeah, I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said about this season, no matter how it ends up, that when everybody showed up and how they showed up, you know, Gillen showed up early enough, but still not like early enough where he could have been, you know, spending time with Leiden, spending time with some of the other guys and you know, getting some tendencies down, creating chemistry. You know, Torian Thompson obviously showed up late. Andrew White showed up late. I mean, these are guys that would normally, like, yes, teams are going to, and especially Syracuse, are going to replace guys on a year-to-year basis, and that shouldn't mean that you just completely tank as a result, but the fact that all these guys were replacements and showed up so late in the game, it can't be overstated how much, like, that lost time for them, whether it was, you know, 2 weeks or 2 months, that they really didn't allow them to develop within what this team can do as well as it could have.
Yeah, I think, and I'll admit, I think I underestimated how important chemistry and just time to learn and develop in the zone is to Syracuse. Obviously, we know we're a very unique program because of the defense we play and the style and everything. I thought that there would be less of a transition, and I thought that the whole, like, argument even before White and, I mean, I think Gillen was in the fold pretty early, but even before White joined, like, I thought the whole, like, the Ennis and stuff, Ennis and Malachi and everyone else leaving early, McCullough even, was a little bit alarmist, and I think that the people who wrote that there were, like, severe consequences from just, like, a rash of players leaving earlier than expected, plus NCAA sanctions, plus everything else, actually wound up being pretty spot on. Imagine how much better this team would be with Malachi Richardson. I think he would be, he was just a really strong go-to scorer who was completely unafraid and could spot up and would be stretching defenses and taking big shots and giving Leiden more room to operate. But also, you know, there'd be less of a necessity to focus on guys like White and Gillen, who, you know, maybe they still come. I think Gillen still would be a guy you need to take in. White, you know, maybe he still comes and understands he's not going to be playing 40 minutes a game. Who knows? But I think that would, I mean, you just go down the line. It starts with, really, Ennis was, like, the first one who was really a problematic to leave because I don't think anyone expected him to be a one-and-done guy, which has been covered a million times. But I almost look at this year, if Syracuse is going to miss the tournament, and this isn't to say that anyone should stay or leave or that they owe anything to the program. Like, you said, Torian, obviously Leiden, and whomever else battle as well. They should all, especially with the new rules, there's no reason for them not to go and at least see what their stock is.
Right.
But if there is a slight bright side to this year being so crappy, it is that it might prove to kind of be a hard reset for the program in terms of just getting themselves, you know, the program getting itself back into a healthier state with its scholarships. Because if you then have all those, we're working in a situation where I think a lot of people assume Lyden would be gone after this year. I bet the coaches think that's a distinct possibility, something they've accounted for. If you bring all those guys back or two of those guys back or something, then you have on a really solid footing and you start to reverse the trend that's happened. And I don't blame anyone who is left for leaving. Like, they do not owe anything to the Syracuse program. They were all fine to leave, even if a lot of them haven't really found immediate success in the NBA. Like, that's totally cool. They're still making millions of dollars. You can't blame them for that. But it has, I just don't think it's not like Kentucky, where Kentucky is built to withstand those losses. Like, that's the way that program is constructed. The program actually kind of runs into, like, a weird spot if you have guys staying, especially if, like the Harrison twins a couple years ago, who were seen as first-round picks and ended up being, like, nice players, but not, like, super superstars, and then they had their minutes eaten into in that season where they went undefeated and then lost to Wisconsin. Them having a bunch of guys stay, they ended up having a great year that year, but it almost made for, like, a weird spot because Cal was always so aggressive in recruiting five stars across the board, so... just very different constructions of programs, and Syracuse is, like, clearly we're equipped to handle, like, a one and done here and there. We recruit them, like, guys who are that good. We go after them, but I think we're going after guys who are going to be one and dones because we expect them to be, not like Ennis, who blew up and was one of the best point guards in the country, or Malachi, who really wasn't even on that radar until the tournament and had a great tournament and took advantage, as he should. So, hopefully... things work themselves out, I think, especially because, like, recruiting this year hasn't been, like, the best class or the most highly touted class that we've had coming in. So that's a really big, like, overarching thing to look at with Syracuse basketball right now. If this year, if it doesn't go well, if that could at least, like, beget a slightly more veteran roster heading into next year, which could be, you know, obviously it could be Bayheim last year, so...
Yeah, and I'll still entertain the factor right now that it could be Boeheim's last year. I think it's just unfortunate the way things are right now that if guys don't come back, we're going to be in a very kind of tenuous spot. Some outside the program may see this as kind of a referendum on the way Boeheim's done things. I don't see it that way. I see it as this is a referendum on a perfect storm of NCAA sanctions, guys leaving early, and Boeheim needing to get outside his comfort zone recruiting, and instead of doing what he has been doing, which is recruiting a lot of 3 and 4 stars, and recruiting against teams that we can beat on the trail, and then the occasional 5, recent program success, again, the lack of roster spots, have forced us to, we don't have time projects, and, you know, Boeheim said in his biography, he didn't want to be up against North Carolina and Kansas and Duke because he couldn't beat them. On a regular basis. And, you know, this year kind of proved it, that when we were forced to, because of the amount of spots that we have available on the roster, we were forced to go after some 4 and 5 star, you know, high 4s and 5 star guys against Kentucky and Kansas and Duke and North Carolina. We've been losing repeatedly. And it's just unfortunate that, you know, when you have, whether it's a Quade Green situation or just a situation where we just haven't been able to get in on those guys early enough. I don't think there's anyone at fault. I just think, again, it's a combination of all of those factors, and it's something that we're going to have to deal with. I don't think that it's a referendum on Boeheim. I just think it's an unfortunate side note to what the end of his career, which could look a little rockier than it should, just because of a couple kind of, you know, recruiting related issues.
Yeah, it's definitely a confluence of things. It's and I think Syracuse, you know, while the zone has become a staple, and I hope Hopkins keeps it in some regard, because we've seen, like, not just, like, a few moments, like, we've seen numerous instances where playing the zone got Syracuse farther than it probably would have gone if it didn't play the zone.
Pretty much
every Final Four run Syracuse has had. Definitely 2013, 96, definitely 96. 03, we had the best player in the country, which helped. Maybe 03 was less zone dependent than some of these other years, but 13, 96, I would argue 16, because, you know, a bunch of those teams were totally flummoxed by it. Even that was even the best zone team. Like, 13 might have been one of our best zone teams, and that offense wasn't very good, but the zone was just so nasty, it didn't matter.
What they did against Marquette in that Elite Eight game is still, like, the frameable, like, this is what the zone does at its peak.
That two-game stretch, which I was at those games in D.C., like, Indiana was probably the most talented team in the country, and we make jokes about Tom Crean to this day based on that game, and the year after didn't help, but, like, that game was, like, the 2-3 zone game, if you have to, like, define one in the Boeheim era, honestly. And then the next day, Marquette, like, or 2 days later, Marquette, like, barely looked like they had ever, like, they, for a while there, it felt like Marquette hadn't scored in 10 minutes. They ended up with, like, what, 47 or something?
I think it was 39.
Was it 39?
It was even... I looked it up. Game.
Yeah, like, the clamps went down so hard in that game. Like, it wasn't even, like, a total rout. Like, it was bad, but Syracuse wasn't scoring either. But, like, there was at no moment... Yeah, because after a while, like, Syracuse would throw a little bit. I think it was, like, maybe, like, 50-something to 39. Was like 57.
I'm going with 57-39 without looking. I'm pretty sure that's the score.
Yeah, I was there. I should know this. actually, I don't know why I expected to know like specific scores of these games. People, I hold myself to too high a standard. 55-39.
Yeah, that's close.
So like, yeah, Syracuse won by 14. It felt like Syracuse was up by 50. Like, because Marquette, which again, this is Buzz Williams, who, as we've covered, knows how to play against his own. Like, pretty much every other time he's coached, like, since he took over for Crean, has done at least a decent job. Even when he wasn't beating Syracuse, it was a talent issue. It wasn't, like, a executing issue. That day, it was an everything issue. And then last year, there were similar things. The defense just really put the clamps on people. This year, unfortunately, it's just a lot of experience, honestly. Last year was a pretty young team, too, but there were still guys who knew what they were doing. This year, it's just... It's Roberson. Like, who's super experienced in the zone? Roberson and Coleman, who's basically isn't playing anymore. I mean, Howard has a year, but he doesn't play that much, and it's a year. Leiden has a year, and he's probably the best zone defender we have because he can play the five and is a dope shot blocker. Like, that's not a lot.
This is worth an article, and I'm kind of calling this out even to the folks on the staff, too, if they want to combine forces, because I don't have the time for this. Looking at maybe the last like 10-15 years and seeing like, is this the lowest percentage of minutes in the zone that like we've ever returned?
It has to be up there,
right? Like, that's what I mean. Like, I think it's pretty close. Even a team that looked like they had a lot of turnover going in, the 09-10 team, and like, I mean, people were talking gloom and doom with that squad, you know, after everybody declared for the draft. And obviously
the guys who declared weren't good zone defenders.
No, they were actually terrible. They were the reason why we were a terrible defensive team.
Right.
And, like, and that's not even not even a knock on those guys. I mean, Paul, Devo, and Johnny all inhabit their own place in Syracuse lore, and for good reason. But they were all bad defenders.
Yeah, I think you could argue maybe Paul was okay, was a decent defender when he had to play the two, which was not 09. He barely played there in 09,
right.
Because we had Routins, who was a great, like, maybe the best at the top of the zone, and then Johnny couldn't play anywhere but the one, and Devo couldn't play anywhere but the two. So, yeah, like, Routins was even playing on the wing that year, which was just weird to think about in retrospect, because 1 year later, and Routins is, like, 8 steals against UNC and totally, like, ran Roy Williams off the court at MSG. So yeah, it's just I think that hypothesis, I can't speak tonight, is probably pretty spot on. Like, I would be surprised if there are many Syracuse teams, maybe 0-3, honestly, because it was so freshman heavy.
Yeah.
But again, like, when you have Carmelo Anthony, that solves a lot of problems. Right. And again, that was a good zone team, but that team, I think, played some more man than usual, if I remember correctly. Not, like, a ton, but it was more man-heavy than some of the other, like, post-96 teams. And, like, obviously that team was an offensive, like, juggernaut because of Carmelo and Jerry and Hack and everyone else. And you had two really experienced centers in the zone who knew what they were doing.
Always helps.
Which is big.
Okay, Okay. On that note, a little halftime. Dan, what have you been drinking?
A decent amount. Since last time, a decent amount of different stuff too. I don't remember if I brought up the Lost Nation Gosa.
You did.
Which I did?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I haven't had another one, but that was good. So since then, I had Innocent Gun, their rum cask aged version of their signature beer, which I've had before. Just really solid. I was at a Scottish themed restaurant, so I figured that was appropriate. And I didn't have a great beer list, but I did have that, so that was good. I had some Sweetwater, which I don't always find up here, but it's always a pretty rock solid drink. A little Two Hearted. Had, which I found a lot recently, Goose Island's Bourbon County Brand Stout, which is delicious as always. Had Allagash, their strong golden ale, which was quite good. Very different from Allagash and their normal Hefeweizens. I really enjoyed that. I don't think I had had that before. I have had from, I think, an Illinois brewery, Moody Tun, their Steeped Emperor's Lemon Saison, which was super interesting. I thought it did a really pretty nice job. It was definitely more, it wasn't like your classic Saison. It was definitely more lemony, but it was really unique. You know, not the best thing I've had this week, but definitely worth a try. Very refreshing. And then probably the best thing I've had this week was Monday. I had Hill Farmstead's Dalty Single Hop Pale Ale, which was absolutely delicious. I mean, Hill Farmstead, like, I almost feel like, I know that there's like plenty of press on them. Like, they are so good. Everything they make is so good.
Yeah, I'm jealous that you get to have them at any point. I've literally never had anything from them because it's hard to find trade partners for them because of their like mostly Vermont specific distro, and like then obviously like if they're on draft, you're not going to be able to trade that.
Yeah, like I see a fair amount of them like at good beer bars down here, but it's always on draft. It's right. Like, I don't know if I've ever actually had like a can or a bottle of Hill Farmstead.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to like set alerts on Untappd when I'm in New York in March.
It's not the hardest thing to find around here, but like you know, you're not going to find cans, so otherwise I would definitely send some over. If I see any, obviously I will, but
fair enough.
Do not remember seeing it anywhere in stores.
Mm. All right, so for me, had a bunch in the last week. Had from King Harbor at Tiki Hut IPA. It's like a tropical IPA they put together. Had Monkish release their latest kind of hazy double IPA, East Coast style. It was a deep concentration. First pour I had of it was good. I wouldn't say like amazing, but then I've noticed with and a lot of other folks have noticed this too, with Monkish's double IPAs and IPAs, you give it like a week and it really starts to drink really well. And I noticed that I've had three of the four cans that I bought from them, and I think they've definitely gotten better with each one, as I've given each one a couple days more. Some others I had. I went down to Brewery Tarot, their sour focused, tasting room, and really cool spot. Had a couple different things. Had their Rosé Goza, which was a very interesting combo and exactly what you would expect from it. I had their Tarte Darkness, but with raspberries and vanilla, which was pretty fantastic. I mean, for those who have had Tarte Darkness, just add two very good flavors, and there you go. And Vindictive, it's their red wine, Black Tuesday hybrid, which was pretty legit. And I also had another, I know it's funny, last week I mentioned a basil saison, and then this week I had another basil saison, the Biravento from the brewery, which was actually better than the full steam one. I was really impressed with that. Had Bottle Logic's Dark Star November, just an Imperial Bourbon Barrel Aged Stout that got rave reviews when it was first released a couple years ago. Noble released their own kind of East Coast style double IPA, 24 karat juice, that was very, very good. I actually got one of the last pours of that Oblate Noble Ale Works. And what else have I had? Oh, and then I also had from Monkish Celestial Fuzz, was a sour blonde, perhaps. I want to say yes. Let's double check. I know it had boysenberry and saison, but with boysenberry and nectarines, It was very, very good. They always put out some great sours. And then last night, had some birthday brews, including Firestone Walker's Helldorado, their blonde barley wine that they make annually. So yeah, busy weekend, but a good one.
Yeah, so in our post-beer segment, which I know, and I want to reiterate our warning for at least one listener.
I'm still we not may sure touch if on he was, if he was trying to be sarcastic and just like forgot the sarcasm part.
Maybe, like it came off like really like pointed. Like I feel like I'm a pretty good judge of sarcasm on the internet, but you know, I apologize if that was sarcasm, even though he never came back to like check in on it. But yeah, we may touch on things that don't pertain only to Syracuse in this segment. I actually don't even know what we're going to talk about, but I wanted to bring this up first. Because it just happened.
Turn it off.
Yeah, you can leave. Like, that's fine. You can have to listen. It's okay. But please do if you're interested. UConn just hired Rhett Lashley as their offensive coordinator.
What's his
Auburn?
Oh.
He all right. So I said, "What? Like, how is that happening?" And then one of the UConn people said that he was making one of the UConn beat writers. Lashley made $600,000 a year at Auburn, and he will make $350,000 a year at UConn, which means he wasn't asked back to Auburn. Like that what that means is
in a state that's Gus more expensive Malzahn, to live in.
Yeah, at a smaller school, Gus Malzahn, like clearly, and this isn't even a knock. This isn't like me trying to troll UConn. Like this is just the reality. He was not asked back to Auburn, which is like we just saw this thing today with Louisville, where it kind of was. Intimated that Todd Grantham wasn't going to return, and then he went and took the Mississippi State job, and apparently Louisville had already like had the framework for a deal with Mississippi State's defensive coordinator, so they wound up just swapping, yeah. Which is hilarious. But yeah, so it's like one of those things where they didn't want to fire him because he was like a guy that came up with Malzahn basically their entire, like, I think he was one of Malzahn's, maybe, I actually looked at the background, I think he was one of his old, like, maybe even high school quarterbacks, and he's kind of just been with him for a while, and Auburn's offense has been kind of a total mess for years since Nick Marshall was there. So it was like I'm reading this as a non-firing. At the same time, UConn under Randy Edson last time ran the most milquetoast, boring, ineffective offense in the world, and now at least we'll have an idea of something interesting. It might not work, it could be awful, but at least it's something that's different and not being run in the AAC, really. So I think that's a good hire for them.
Well, it's interesting now, too, because, I mean, you remember that article I wrote last year talking about how we were kind of a unique selling proposition in the Northeast. Now, at this point, we're not a unique selling proposition. I would argue that the BC...
They're very different offenses.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, in general, I would say, like, BC has become the only stereotypical Northeast offense left, and that's only going to...
Meatheadish?
Yeah, meatheadish, as one editor of a certain website coined on Brent Axe's program today. But yeah, it's weird that BC wants to tether themselves to that when literally every other school in the region, including UMass, has moved far away from it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that you can almost argue that they're now the inefficiency, which I don't buy, because the inefficiency, like running a bad pro style offense that's been bad for years, like I don't think that's an effective thing, even if it's now unique. But you know, whatever works, I guess, or whatever doesn't work, but. Is good, just good enough,
Maryland.
I guess. They did do that, yeah. It's a great win.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's better. Is it better to have a terrible offense and schedule yourself to a smart point to get yourself to a bowl game and still look terrible doing it, or is it better to make all the hires to run a good offense if you're like Rutgers and still be terrible?
That's actually more of an interesting debate. I like to think that the latter is the better process, but college football is very fire happy now.
And fire happy. Like
I don't
detrimentally so.
Yeah, in a lot of cases. I know we had we talked about Sonny Dykes a little bit earlier, which was like kind of a unique situation, but I don't think coaches are being given a lot of headway or time to develop their systems. So I think you have to have a lot of trust in your athletic director and your fan base to like fully implement something. And for UConn, like, this is definitely going to be a thing, because I know there isn't much like way, there isn't a lot of room to dope it up, so that helps, I guess. But like, they don't have the pieces for a Gus Malzahn offense, so it's going to take a little bit. But they were so bad to begin with that like whatever year one looks like probably isn't going to be any worse.
I guess my thing is, like, where are you going to find the pieces for a Gus Malzahn offense, though, in the Northeast?
It's a good question, especially when you're playing outside in a stadium an hour and a half away from your campus. Not an hour and a half, it's like an hour, whatever. Yeah, it's still far. Farther than they want to tell you. Like, you're not going to see Rentschler on an official visit unless they're, like, bussing everyone over there, and then it's kind of, like, very revealing of how far that is. Yeah, it's interesting. I give them credit, because it is a little bit of outside-the-box thinking, and, like, all the sum of all fears with Randy Edsall returning is, like, now UConn is a lower-ceiling program than they were when he left because of the conference they're in, and he's never shown a propensity towards running an interesting offense. I think he kind of sort of tried at Maryland, but it was an abject failure pretty much every time.
It's also because he's like a fifth-string quarterback the whole time.
That didn't help.
Detrimental, yeah, to say
slash linebacker, not the best. So I will say, like, this is an interesting move, and I mean, Lashley's had some success. Obviously, being behind Malzahn kind of shields like the amount of credit you get, but also the amount of blame. But like, he's been there since 13. Like, he's there when they developed that Nick Marshall team, which was crazy. The problem is, like, the last couple years have left a lot to be desired, to the point where, like, Malzahn, hey, this year seems a defensive team, and Malzahn, like, is himself gonna probably come close to the hot seat at some point if they don't start figuring out this offense. He looked into Jarrett Stidham leaving Baylor, which I think will be very good for Auburn, but obviously the jury's out on how good Lashley will be, but again, like, I think when you're UConn, going outside the box is probably a good thing, and we'll see how it goes, because it, again, cannot be worse than the last, like, 3 years of UConn's offense. Or the last, really, like, however many years since Edsall left of UConn's offense.
Yeah, and on that note, I think we're good on UConn talk for today, because you've already gotten more time than you deserve, Huskies.
That's fair. We haven't talked about Tulane in, like, months, so...
We haven't.
I agree.
Well, we might get to Tulane today. I feel like it might have to be tabled. I did want to talk about Monday's game, the college football playoff national championship. I'm sure many watched. Clemson won. I wasn't happy about it. I also felt like Alabama did a lot of un-Alabama things to get there, including the final play when they pretty much handed Clemson a wide-open touchdown and committed a penalty to get them close enough for that wide open touchdown. Both of those moves just did not seem like Saban-esque things for a team to do, especially a team that was loaded with talent on the defensive side.
Yeah, I think the thing people have been saying is just Alabama's offense, what they have, 11 straight three and outs or like third down attempts. I think with the way the pace, I mean, Clemson played at a ridiculous pace. They ran, what, 98, 99 plays?
That's smart.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Clemson does, and they did it, like, really, really well, and there's only so much you can do with a tired defense. Like, it's a tired, really, really good defense, but keeping those players on the field mitigates a lot of the depth that Alabama dominates with, and then just having Deshaun Watson, like, we've talked about the one thing that Clemson had a definitive edge on over Alabama was at quarterback. They had by far the better quarterback, and in college football, that means, I mean, in any level of football, it means a lot. We've seen Alabama overcome it in recent years. Last year, obviously, was the other Clemson-Alabama game where, you know, Coker was fine, Watson was still way better. And Alabama is, like, one of those teams that can overcome that, but most of the time, I'd say, if you have a better quarterback by the margin between 2016 Deshaun Watson and Jalen Hurts, like, you're going to win the game most of the time. And Alabama just couldn't quite mitigate it because Watson started dialing up plays by the bunches in the fourth quarter.
He did whatever the hell he wanted in the fourth. Like,
yeah, he was so good. Like, this is a weird year because Clemson, like people, I almost think underplayed, especially when heading into the matchup, they like underplayed how iffy Clemson looked throughout most of the year.
Yeah, I mean,
they lost to Pitt, and Pitt was fine. They weren't great, obviously. They almost lost to Troy. They should have lost to NC State. They almost lost to Auburn when Gus Malzahn looked like he was actively trying to hurt his team with how he managed quarterbacks. I think we talked about that after that happened. Still to this day, one of the worst bouts of coaching I've ever witnessed from a coach that almost won a national championship. Or that almost won a national... No, did win a national championship with Cam Newton. No, he wasn't head coach. He was assistant. He was OC. Almost won one. They lost to... who beat Auburn?
Florida State.
Right.
In a game that they should have won.
Yeah, like, had Florida State on the ropes. Basically, like, that Auburn was to Alabama to what Florida State, Clemson was to Florida State. Like, those games actually kind of tracked very similarly. Not because of the pace, but just in terms of, like, the flow of the game. But yeah, Clemson just, I think they just wore that defense down, and football, the offense has edges in a lot of ways, and when you're keeping the same 11 on the field, like, no matter how good they are, it's going to be hard for them to deal with guys like Deshaun Watson and Mike Williams and whomever else. I think that, like, you'll almost see the difference between the programs, and, like, Clemson clearly, like, they deserve to win the game. Next year, Clemson's going to lose Watson, they lose Wayne Gallman, they lose Mike Williams and Artavis Scott, and then a host of those defensive players. I would be very surprised if Clemson was a New Year's Six team next year. I think they'll be pretty good, but I think it'll be a major step down. Alabama doesn't have those. Like, that's the difference. Alabama will sustain pretty much any loss. Like, they can lose 10 guys to the NFL early, and they will have 10 more step right in. Clemson is not quite at that level. No one really is. So that'll be where you see the difference, and like Alabama will be right back in the title conversation next year. I don't think Clemson will be on paper.
I think
maybe Trevor Lawrence. Maybe they could. I mean, as Florida State did this year, they were similar.
Well, right, and yeah, you look. I mean, just how the arrangement goes too is that the ACC is guaranteed a spot. Therefore, like, okay, well, who else is going to get it? The Coastal is
and
a mess.
If you assume Florida State's going to be really good, which I think they should be,
national title. Then you calling it right now.
Maybe. I think
ACC back to back.
That's the one thing. It's like I find it hard to root for Clemson. And if you want to know why, just to look at Brent Axe's tweets from Jay Slater. That's a good indicator. I will say I was very happy for the ACC to get another title. The ACC, and I said it after the game, and this isn't like a hot take anymore. Like, this is just kind of well regarded at this point, even Paul Feinbaum agrees. The ACC was the best conference in college football this year. At the end of the day.
Yeah.
Like, I was on board, say, the Big Ten heading in, but I didn't think the margin was that huge. And the Big Ten, like, I don't think bowl games are everything, but the Big Ten, like, really shit the bed in the bowl games, and the ACC was just so good. It wasn't, like, a couple-game difference. The ACC was so much better than every other power conference in the bowl games, and including winning the national title, winning two other New Year's Six games, Florida State beating Michigan, a team that, you know, was on the fringe of the playoff, and Florida State wasn't really. It was looked at as, like, a kind of a rebuild year for Florida State. Like, maybe I don't think the ACC was like that much better than the Big Ten or the SEC, but I think they were. I think they were better. And when was the last time the ACC could say it was the best conference in college football, even if only for a year? I don't know. I really couldn't tell you.
1950s somewhere when they maybe started.
I don't. Yeah, and there was like what? How many conferences were there? Not that many. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's a good thing for Syracuse. Like the ACC was really good this year, and it wasn't just at the top. Like, there were some really solid programs all across, and even when, like, Syracuse is one of the bad teams, quote-unquote, in the ACC, it's one of the few teams that didn't make a bowl, there were, Syracuse was, I think Syracuse would have beaten the hell out of, healthy at least, would have beaten the hell out of the 12th best team in every other conference, probably.
Yeah.
Like, Syracuse versus who in the SEC is, like, the 12th best team?
Ole Miss?
Mississippi.
Maybe not.
Ole Miss is, like, had a weird year. They had no defense, so it would have been interesting. But, like, I mean, Kansas, obviously. Yeah, I think Syracuse would have smoked Mizzou. I know Mizzou had like a nice win over Arkansas at the end of the year, but who didn't? I think the world had a nice win over Arkansas at the end of the year.
Actually, we have a transitive win over Arkansas. So
you're right. Who in the Pac-12? Who's number 12 of the Pac-12? Or even if you want to do like number
Oregon
10
State.
Of the Pac-12, since
well, 12 is Oregon.
Oh, we would have.
Yeah, we would destroyed.
I would say it wasn't. I would say it was probably better than I thought they would be this year. I think Syracuse would have beat them without too much of an issue.
Number
10, if we're assuming it's Dungy, Syracuse.
Number 10 was probably ASU, which is a little iffy.
Yeah, that would have been, oh my God, there would have been so many points.
them or Cal, and either of those would have been a fun game.
If Syracuse played Arizona State this past year, I would believe you if you said that Syracuse scored 80 points and lost. I think just overall, like, the ACC top to bottom was really strong. And when you have teams like Pitt, who was, you know, I don't think they were great, but they were good enough to beat Clemson. And they were, you know, middle tier, I'd say. And they beat Penn State, too. Not Penn State wasn't playing the way they were at the end of the year, but they beat them. I think it was a really nice year to be a Go ACC fan. And should hopefully help continue to help put to rest, like, the whole... I mean, I don't know that you can really even give an argument to the pro-Big East, staying in the Big East people at this point. I think they're too far gone. But just another, you know, example that this was a nice, really legitimate power conference to go to. Because just a couple years ago, people were, you know, making fun of the ACC like it was just this awful thing. Even when this is the second national title in four or five years for the ACC, like, it's doing pretty well for itself at the top, too. So,
agreed. Dan, you have any other topics today? I feel like, we rarely have an episode that goes under an hour, but at the same time, I feel like I don't want to just belabor this thing because we don't have, just make sure it hits an hour.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have anything else. I mean, it was kind of a late week aside from the Virginia Tech game. Recruiting should start picking back up because I think the dead period end tomorrow, I think?
Something like that.
Soon. In the next couple of days, and then obviously you have, you know, college football's actually over, which is very sad.
Longest offseason
RIP.
Ever.
It really is. College football offseason. I mean, it helps that you have like little intermediate things like signing day and then spring football. Like, there are little things here and there. But like actual
starting.
Oh, yes. 130 of them this year.
Yeah,
what up, Coastal Carolina?
I'm very much looking forward to riding hard for the Chanticleers next year.
The Joe Moglia era in FBS begins.
That's going to last like 3 years. Because he's like, super old.
Is he in his 70s? He's close.
I think he's close.
Yeah. It is a long offseason. And it's going to be a few longer if Syracuse basketball doesn't have a miraculous turnaround. He is 67, so yeah.
I got 3 years. Like, he's
that sounds about right. That's not a bad
program up for like a like if some other stupid realignment thing happens, he's gonna set up Coastal to like get like a look from Conference USA, and like that's gonna be enough. He's gonna be like, all right.
Yeah, and they'll probably endow their coaching spot or something silly, and they'll have way more money to spend on a coach than they have any right to.
Right. Which is fine. I'm fine with Coastal Carolina being good. Maybe they'll even steal their coach from Clemson.
Yeah, we'll see.
No,
Clemson's really well established. I think Clemson. Here's the thing: like, people were talking about like the ratings being down, and a lot of that I think is that Clemson was in the game. Clemson's not really a brand, like a big brand. There's not that many of those in college football. I don't think Clemson's there, but I think if anyone's going to become one, like, they're in pretty good. They're well situated because. I don't think they're going anywhere unless Dabo leaves, and I don't think Dabo would leave unless Alabama approaches him after Saban retires. So
it's Alabama only. I also think that, I think Clemson is. You know, I think Bill wrote a good article about this on SB Nation the other day. He was talking about like this really was a 5-year build, and it started with that disaster of an Orange Bowl game. The Clemson we grew up with is not this Clemson. The Clemson that, you know, a lot of the people we talk to about Clemson online with, this isn't the Clemson they grew up with either. I think Clemson, you're right, is here to stay as long as Dabo's there. If Dabo leaves, then things get a little bit iffier. because of the rising tide of schools in the ACC. You look at the fact that South Carolina has proven they're one good hire away from being a top 5-7 team. If the SEC East gets their shit together, there's a lot of factors that have allowed for this. I'm not going to say that Clemson's due for a fall. I'm just saying that there are a lot of factors that help them get here besides the internal ones. And if those external factors start shifting the other way, that's when things could turn heavily for Clemson in the negative sense.
Yeah, that's like the one difference is that like if they can't follow, like who knows when Dabo leaves, but if they can't follow him up with another great hire, which is not exactly even like a thing that like every, you know, for lack of a better term, blue blood college football program is immune from. Like Alabama has had down periods, Texas has had down periods, etc. But those like programs, just because of who they are, still attract like a certain amount of people to watch them no matter what. Michigan, like they didn't have a good coach for a while, and even, you know, Lloyd Carr was a good coach, but he wasn't a great coach.
USC, and Texas.
Yeah, like those are the type of programs that when you match two of them up in the national championship, you'll get bonkers ratings, and Clemson isn't quite there yet.
There's also 11 podcasts.
I wonder how that works, because that was really only the rating for the ESPN cast, right? Like that didn't add up.
Yeah, I didn't watch a second of the regular broadcast. I just watched the coaches thing the whole time.
I had the regular broadcast on TV, and then I was like listening to the coaches on my computer. Because I wanted to hear what Dino had to say, which was mostly good stuff. I really enjoyed Dino. He was great. And, like, obviously we're biased, but, like, he was so much fun, and pretty much the rest of the internet agreed.
Yeah. The internet loves Babers, and that's a great thing, and especially a great counter to the internet hating our old coach.
Yes. And being totally ambivalent about Doug Marone. Yeah.
Like, oh, that guy. ESPN loved Doug Marone, though.
ESPN did love Doug Marone, and, hopefully, I think Doug Marone's going to do a good job with the Jaguars.
I think he is. I think he's going to do a very good job with the Jaguars. Because that division is super winnable.
Yeah, and like hopefully they give him enough time, because like I hope he doesn't have... I don't hope Bortles' success isn't like pinned to Doug Marone. Like I hope if Bortles doesn't work out, he gets his own quarterback shot. But like if Bortles like finds himself or Marone gets to get another quarterback, like I think he will work out, because I mean, people doubt, like, obviously the St. Doug thing was kind of silly, but he did go 9-7 with the Bills, like, with Kyle Orton playing quarterback.
You know that's pretty good. That's the signing there as a free agent, right?
Oh, I really hope so. We need to have, and Tom Coughlin overseeing, well, that's the other thing. Tom Coughlin's there. Doug Marone's going to get the time. He's going to get a fair shake, I think, because we know Coughlin and Marone are tight. Like, the Syracuse Mafia is real in Jacksonville right now.
As Kevin wrote about the other day, the whole city of Jacksonville is all about Syracuse stuff.
What a city to have be Syracuse South, Jacksonville, Florida.
Duval. There,
God.
Yeah, Jacksonville's fun. Anyway, I think that's a great place to end here. Dan, any parting thoughts for everybody?
Everything in the world truly does end in Jacksonville, so yes. and this podcast will as well, in keeping with the cycles of the universe.
Fair enough. Dan, thank you as always for joining. It's been a pleasure.
Always is.
And that was Dan. I'm John. Thanks for tuning in to Troy Noon's and Absolute Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and go Orange.
Go Orange.